Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. Today's guest is Dr. Devorah Heitner. She's the founder and director of Raising Digital Natives, a resource for parents and schools seeking advice on how to help children thrive in a world of digital connectedness. Dr. Heitner also serves as a resource for schools wishing to cultivate a culture of responsible digital citizenship. And she is also the author of ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Dr. Heitner, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Now, I would say that this is also a book that helps parents to survive in their child's digital world.
Absolutely. And sometimes it feels like it's their digital world and we're just there to, you know, pay the bill. So, absolutely.
Now, when you say digital natives, what are we actually talking about?
Well, in my book, ScreenWise, and in my work, I think of really the touchscreen generation. But I think many of today's millennials could lay claim to being digital citizens, digital natives, even those who are currently in the workplace in their 20s and even early 30s, I believe, are considered millennials. And so, and a lot of those kids grew up with some form of social networking. But I would consider it really to be the touchscreen generation and the wireless generation, you know, people who don't remember dial-up, kids who are really fully in it. Internet is like the most convenient thing for them. And they don't think about, you know, if they're curious about something, they want to know, hey, do cats and dogs have dreams? My 7-year-old was asking me this morning, we have dreams. Does the cat have dreams? And instantly he wanted to Google it, right? That's what I think of as a digital native.
Okay. And of course it makes Google very happy.
Of course.
Now, you begin your book acknowledging that for most adults today, textbooks, binders, number two pencils, those were the tools of the trade, if you will, for going to school. And now the classrooms are very different. What are they like nowadays?
Well, kids in many, many schools are one-to-one, or there are still many schools also where there's a cart full of either tablets or a laptop going around. But either way, kids are using a lot more tech during the school day in many school districts and independent schools around the country. And that experience is similar to the workplace, right? In some ways, I'm always surprised that parents are surprised that computers are going into schools and that kids are using these tools, because very few of us would go into our workplace without access to a computer, email, right? Some of these very basic tools, the internet, right? We wouldn't really expect someone to work without those things now. But a lot of parents are surprised and a little dismayed that their kids have tech in schools. And for teachers, it's great or it's not great. You know, it really depends if a teacher has a plan, if a teacher is able to use technology to extend kids' learning and to make herself into the lead learner, which sometimes means that she's not always the expert in front of the room, then it can be great. If teachers feel a little overwhelmed by the fact that kids have access to technology, if they feel intimidated by the ways that kids can seem so familiar and expert, even though I would argue that kids have certain things they need mentorship on, a lot of kids seem like they know. If that intimidates teachers, that can really make for a difficult classroom dynamic. So I think technology in schools can be amazing, but it has to be done well. And teachers really need to be supported and given useful, you know, instruction, professional development, and also given permission to use tech as they see fit, right? We don't want teachers feeling like they've been forced to use technology just because it's there. We want teachers to use it when it extends kids' learning and opportunities for kids to be creative. And this is true for parents as well. I think kids should be creating with tech more than they're consuming, and it's often the other way around.
Can you give me a sense of what a tech-savvy ideal classroom would look like? How would it operate?
Every classroom is different. I think an ideal classroom is one where the teachers and the students are learning, where the students feel safe and they feel safe to make mistakes. And so it doesn't have to be tech, but one way tech can promote that is kids can, for example, give answers to certain questions anonymously and contribute to, a survey or something like that. And that might empower quieter kids to get involved in some aspects of class discussion. Or even if it's not anonymous, just the fact that you could use a comment feature might, again, empower someone who might be shy or less comfortable speaking in class for whatever reason. And I'm not suggesting that as a substitute for class discussion of the kind of more typical kind that we all grew up with, but just as a way to extend it or as an alternative that's used occasionally. There's so many great ways that classrooms are changing. Teachers are flipping their classrooms where kids are watching, students are watching lectures at home and then coming in to do more experiential kinds of learning and experiments in class or collaborations in class. That's another way that technology can really change how school works. But I don't think that it makes school necessarily better just to, it's not just like, well, add three iPads and call me in the morning. I mean,
Gotcha.
school can be better or worse with tech. A great teacher is great whether or not she has tech too. And I think that's really important to remember. But certainly, I've seen a lot of really creative teachers use tech to support student learning in incredible ways.
Is it your sense that parents and or children are aware of the lifespan of things that get posted or researched online?
I think parents forget often, and that's why I advise parents to ask their kids' permission before they share photographs of their children. And I advise them to really consider what they share about their kids because they may be forgetting that their kids are entering this social universe too. And although they may choose a different platform, if their parents have been publicly posting about them, they'll be able to find that and they may have some feelings about it later. So it's good to remember that your child will, sooner than you think, be kind of playing the same space. I think it's easy for kids also to forget who they're sharing with or how public things are on the internet, and that's why we need to remind them. But in a, I like to stay very positive and focus on the positive impacts of what they share. I think a lot of parents get really worried about kids sharing something negative to the point where maybe we try to scare kids with the story of what bad things can happen to you if you sully your digital reputation. And I think we can go overboard with those warnings, and instead, we may want to think about who is a positive example, someone with a positive digital footprint that can inspire our kids to use their own digital footprint for something good.
Okay, what does digital footprint actually mean?
So, digital footprint is the things that I can find out. For example, before we schedule this interview, I looked you up and I looked at your show and I looked at your website and I listened to episodes and I looked at your Twitter and your Facebook. And most of us have a digital footprint. Some of us are more public than others. Obviously, not everyone has, a show on the radio and a million different social media accounts, but a lot of people have some digital footprint where if you Googled them or used another search engine, you might find their LinkedIn or you might find out where they live and how much they paid for that house, or all kinds of other data. So it's good to know what's out there about you, and kids should start looking by middle school to make sure that they know what's out there about them.
Is there a way for children and parents to monitor what's out in the digital world?
Absolutely. So if you are interested in setting up an alert, I have a Talkwalker alert, for example, on my own name, and that's helpful. So I get an email if people are writing about me. It's helpful to have an unusual name like I do in this case. If you have a very common first name, last name combination, you might get a lot of false alarms. If you set it up to look for your names, you might have to use other data to add to the search to make it more clear, like maybe your middle name or where you live or something else. But yeah, I think it's a great idea to do that. Certainly by high school, you want kids to be setting that up for themselves as opposed to having the parents be tracking their digital footprint.
And that's an app that you've just identified. Can you repeat the name?
Sure, it's called talkwalker.com. Other people like using a Google Alert. There are a number of apps that you can use that are kind of like web screeners that if a certain term comes up, it'll send you, a weekly update and say, oh, so I have other Google alerts on other terms that I follow as well.
Gotcha. Now, you say that, I mean, the name of your book is Screen Wise, and you say that yes. screen wisdom is neither operational or functional. It is about relationships. Can you say yeah. more about that?
Sure. When I get an email that upsets me, if I, you know, I'm not being thoughtful, if I'm not being screen wise, I could easily fire back a really angry response. But this sort of my experience, my screen wisdom, my lived experience tells me that ideally a difficult conversation is face to face. If that's not possible, ideally I'm not responding from a place of anger or reactivity. So that comes from experience. That comes from making the wrong choice. That comes from having done it and having it not go well before. Our kids haven't had those experiences. They don't know. They may know all about how to set up a game and get to the next level, but they don't know what to do if they have a conflict with a friend who they're playing the game with, how to resolve that in a way that they can go on being friends and potentially go on playing the game, right? Like, conflict isn't bad. You know, sometimes teachers or parents want to shut everything down the minute there's conflict. We need to teach kids how to deal with it in a healthy way. That doesn't mean you had a conflict with your friend, you can never play Minecraft again. But how can you move forward?
Gotcha. Do you think that parents, by and large, are as attentive as would be useful to their children's social media accounts, or do they need to be?
I think parents should be attentive to the overall picture of their kids' digital life, maybe more so than tuning into, like, the super specifics of what's going on each day on text or on Instagram. But I would say, certainly as a parent of a middle schooler in particular, which is a very transitional time and most kids are new to these things, you would want to know what apps they are using. If they have your permission, they shouldn't be using apps without your permission at that age, right? You're probably a pretty big part of how they have that device or that phone. So it seems like they should be going through you. And a lot of these apps are also 13 and up. So again, if they're going to go around those age limits, they should have your permission. And then you want to know how is their experience overall? You know, are they feeling reactive? Are they feeling excluded? Are there other interpersonal challenges coming up in social media or gaming for your child, or even via text? So I don't think you necessarily want to read every text your child is sending, for example. I think for most parents that would be overkill, but it might be reasonable to have conversations with them where you say, if I did look at your text, what would I see? Where should I be concerned? Or can you show me an example of something someone else has texted that you don't think is so friendly? And how do you handle that? Or even before they ever get a phone, what would you do if someone texts something that's not very friendly?
So would you recommend that parents have the passwords so that they can actually get into their children's accounts? I know a lot of certainly teenagers would object to that.
It is completely your prerogative if you want to do that, but I strongly suggest if you do it that you let your children know. I don't think we want to get into covertly monitoring our kids, because we really paint ourselves into a corner. If I covertly monitor my child and I see that they're doing something that concerns me, or there's something ambiguous, like their mental health seems concerning, or a friend is in trouble, or they're talking about something that might be illegal, do I then go to them and say, hey, I've been reading all your texts? How does that work with going forward and being helpful to them and having a trusting relationship? So I think if you are reading your child's text, or you have their password and reserve the right to read them, you should let them know exactly what you're doing. You could say, I have your password, but I'm only going to read your social media messages if you give me reason to be concerned, if your behavior gives me reason to be concerned, if you're ever out and I can't find you, that might be something I would do, and you don't call. If there are other red flags in your behavior and you won't talk to me, this is something that I might do because I have your password. But or you could say, once a week, I'm going to check your texts and see what I think. And then if I'm not concerned in 6 months, I'm going to cut down on that kind of checking. But I think you should be clear with your child about what you're using their password for. And I do think having the password a condition of having certain accounts could be great, especially, again, for those newer users, those younger, even upper elementary schoolers, your fifth, sixth, seventh grader. And even if you're not regularly checking, they should always know that if something's happening online that makes them uncomfortable, they should be able to use you and your rules as an excuse. In other words, you may not be reading every text, but I think it's very helpful for a sixth grader in a group text or on Instagram to say, you know, that comment makes me uncomfortable, and by the way, my dad looks at my phone. Or I don't like what you said. And by the way, my mom checks my phone and I could get in trouble. Now, a 10th grader isn't going to do that. Their parents may still be looking at their phone. I kind of hope that by high school, most parents feel more confident about their kids', day-to-day interactions. But even if parents are not looking at phones in high school, you could certainly mention that. Or you could, in 10th grade, maybe be more ready to stand up and just say, I don't like that kind of language. I'm not going to continue communicating with you if you use it. Whereas a 6th grader might not be ready to be that assertive in their relationships. And it might be more comfortable for them to say, my dad looks at my phone, so don't say that. Don't use those words. I'll get in trouble. Right. And then we kind of expect kids to take over. I think at all ages, including adults, everyone should know that if you're being harassed or threatened digitally, you must get help. And that's true for adults. If an adult is being harassed or threatened digitally, they should be getting help as well. And so kids need to know, we encourage our kids to solve their own problems, but kids need to know at a certain point that they cannot solve things on their own, and that that's okay too, that no one would expect them to solve a problem that's so big on their own. So we really need to clarify with kids, what our expectations are, and be very clear that if someone's scaring them or harassing them or anything like that online, they should absolutely, or trying to extort them in any way or ask for inappropriate pictures, that's when they should immediately get an adult.
Now, you've also said that perhaps neither parents or children recognize that everything that gets posted is on the internet. It's just there, and you can't really take it down. Is that true? And if you post something in a private Facebook account, for example, is that still there for all time?
Well, you can always take something down. If you've personally posted it on social media, you can take it down. The internet does have various ways of things being remembered, and anything that we've shared can theoretically be screenshotted or copied or reshared by someone else. And once that's happened, it's out of our control. If I make a Facebook post complaining about my employer or someone else in my community, and I get a better idea and think, wow, that wasn't so smart, and I take it down 2 hours later, there's no way for me to know for sure that nobody's shared it. I mean, if I don't see any shares, that's one indication, but it could still have been screenshotted, et cetera. So it's very concerning. And a lot of times if we, tweet something or share something negative, we might think the better of it and erase it. But depending how closely watched your accounts are and how many people are following you, you may find that someone saw that, even if it was just there for a short amount of time. That's why we shouldn't be composing in that space. If you have something to share that's more complex, you may want to compose it in a word processing program and, have a few people look at it even before you post it. There's no, we shouldn't be in such a rush to get things out there.
Are there typical apps that younger folks are likely to use these days?
Well, the really little kids are very into Musical.ly and YouTube. And Musical.ly is this fun app where you basically kind of lip sync to popular songs and other things, and it's very attractive to even elementary schoolers. They love it, but it is a social app, and so you can have people following your elementary schooler, and that's where, as a parent, I would be very cautious.
Sure.
In elementary school, having kids be in a social app or playing games on a public server, you want to be really involved. I mean, again, I really strongly stress mentorship over monitoring as an approach. So I'm not suggesting, again, covertly monitoring, but if somebody's friends with my first grader in Musical.ly, I want to know that person. And so I think a reasonable rule for elementary schoolers might be, hey, you can't connect with somebody digitally unless I know them, like me, your mom. Not even, I mean, in middle school, the rule could be you have to know them. I don't want you having friends online that you haven't met face to face. But in elementary school, it kind of seems like if you're going to be social at all, it should be like, because my kid doesn't have other friends that I don't know. Right? He doesn't have kids over on play dates that I don't know. He's 7 years old.
Good point.
So if he were to connect with other people on Musical.ly, it should be people that I know. And if I don't know them, he can wait and connect with them after I've met them. Right? So I really think that's Musical.ly is one example of an app where I think a lot of parents were surprised because it seems like such a cute, fun app, and it is, but kids are connecting, and you can have adults connecting with and following your child on an application potentially, and that adult. If that adult is not someone you know or in your family, I would be very confused and concerned about why they're following your child and watching them do lip sync videos, like why that's interesting or appealing to them. Same thing with YouTube. A lot of kids are super into YouTube, and even pre-literate kids can use YouTube, right? A preschooler can search a bunch of videos in their interest area and find really great, really compelling content. On the other hand, there's a lot of things on YouTube that I don't even want to see. There's, beheadings, there's terrible things, there's violence, there's very degrading and violent pornography. There's a lot of stuff that I think most of us don't want to see and wouldn't want our children to see. And it's surprisingly easy to stumble on very creepy, disturbing content in YouTube. So, unfortunately, I would say for elementary schoolers and preschoolers, YouTube, I would say, is a parental supervision app, which is a real pain in the neck. I know, because most parents would love for their kids to just be able to use YouTube unsupervised. But if you can be in the room at least when they're surfing YouTube, if not actually sitting down with them, that's ideal at that age, because it's very easy to find creepy content, and there are people making content that we don't want our kids to see, in with names and things that would actually attract children. So it's actually, there's an intention. There are people, who knows who these people are, but who have bad intentions out there. It's not even like they're just, yeah, it's unfortunate.
It's pretty
So
scary, yeah.
as kids get older, they're going to find those things on their own, and we need to teach them what to do if they find things that are negative or upsetting. But when our kids are little, we really need to ideally be with them. So if they're going to use a tablet, for example, at a time that we can't supervise, it's ideal if they're using an app like a drawing app or an app where we know more about the content or a game. But having them be sort of on open search on YouTube, like say
Not a
a
good plan.
preschooler, that's
Yeah.
not such a great
Gotcha.
plan.
Devorah Heitner is author of Screenwise. Did I say, I'm sorry, we're going to cut this piece out, but is it Devorah or pronounce your name for me again?
Sure, it is Devorah. You
It's
said it
Devorah.
correctly when
Okay.
you first introduced me. That was great.
Okay, terrific. All right. We're talking to Devorah Heitner, who is author of Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Dr. Heitner, we've been talking about the things that parents should be concerned about or at least aware of with their children. Are there schools that have social media policies in general?
Yes, schools could be doing a better job on this. And part of the challenge for schools is that schools are bureaucracies, right? Most schools are big, and certainly bigger than your family anyway. And so it's hard to be quick and nimble and change the rules every 5 minutes. So you definitely see a lot of schools where the signs, that say no cell phones still show pictures of pagers, or like they're, telling parents, that kids can't use MySpace anymore, and maybe the parents are the MySpace generation. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's very hard to keep up. There are other schools that are very up to the minute on maybe what kids are doing, but don't necessarily know how to deal with policies. What do you do when kids are, for example, unkind to one another on a social app, and these kids know each other from school, they go to school together, but the activity is not happening at school, right? They're going online in the evening and getting involved in a group text or a social app, and maybe things aren't going perfectly as they should. Things are uncomfortable in some way, right? What do you do in that situation as a school? And I think a lot of schools want to turn that back to parents, and parents want to turn that back to schools. Everyone is looking at the other party and saying, "You deal with this," and no one really wants to put their hands on it because it's uncomfortable. What do you, sometimes it's really gross. Sometimes the content that kids share with one another is upsetting to adults. So it's very tough, and I think schools don't have ideal solutions worked out.
So it sounds like parents need to have solutions worked out or procedures worked out for their children who are going to school, that they communicate to the child and perhaps to the school, to the teacher. Would that make sense?
It really depends. If you have specific concerns, like, for example, if your child is using technology at school and running into a problem, and I've heard this story from many families that in school districts I've worked with, where the students are supposed to use an online forum for a class, for example, and maybe the interactions aren't so nice in that online forum, but the teacher hasn't checked in on the online forum in a while and hasn't seen that kids are being unkind. So it's like an extreme example, but it has happened at some schools. Parents absolutely should let the teachers know, like, hey, this is happening. The kids are supposed to be talking about social studies in Edmodo or Haiku or whatever online space that you've, you know, organized for them, and things have degenerated, or Google Docs, right? It can happen anywhere. And the schools have a fair amount, if it's happening in school, the schools have a fair amount of both obligation and ability to deal with it. So that's one type of situation. Absolutely, parents should let kids know, hey, don't text me during the school day, don't text anyone. If you do bring your phone to school, it shouldn't be out during class unless the teacher's doing an activity and says, everyone get out your phones. You know, that happens in some schools, but it's a bit unusual. In most schools, the policy is it should be turned off and in your locker all day. So if that's the policy, that's what kids should do. And whether you agree with that policy or not, I would suggest not undermining it. You know, if maybe you disagree with the policy, but don't text your kid during the school day, they're going to get in trouble.
Gotcha. If your child is being bullied online, and it's happening just as they leave school, but from kids who are in school, what's a parent's first step?
It is a really tough one. I would absolutely get the principal, the child's teacher, the school counselor involved. But I would also try to find out as much as possible from your child and know that you may not get the full picture. So you may very well get a transcript of a conversation at some point if there is more involvement that shows that your child may have played a role in back and forth aggressive communication. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean your child isn't being bullied or that your child doesn't need protection or help, but you may see things that make you uncomfortable when you start to delve into digital communication, when you start bringing in other people. But we have to keep our kids safe, and that's our first obligation. So hopefully you won't need to involve law enforcement. Things have to get pretty extreme before a school or a parent might choose to do that, but that can happen. You can sometimes get things shut down by the apps themselves. If a page is harassing or if certain content is harassing or threatening, the app theoretically can take it down if it's reported, but I wouldn't hold my breath. And the other thing is, if your child is being bullied in a specific app, I would ask them to consider taking a break from that app. So if your child is being harassed or bullied in Ask.fm, you can even say, look, maybe you don't have to, you know, first you could close your account completely, or you could just take it off of your phone for a while so you can't see it. People don't really have as much power to get to us through social media if we choose not to be on social media, and it kind of depends how public a person you are. If you're a movie star, or the president, or, you know, a very public person, people can talk about you in social media and it can still affect your reputation. But if you're a private person and a seventh grader and you're not a public figure and someone's harassing you on Instagram and they don't get the satisfaction of a reaction because you've gotten yourself off of Instagram, that could be one solution, right? It's not necessary, you know, it really depends on the sort of intensity of what's happening. If someone's making physical threats, then go to law enforcement. If someone's making not nice comments on your photos, maybe stop engaging with them or unfollow them, right? I mean, you could also cut off contact with that specific person in the app. So there's such a range, unfortunately, of both positive and negative experiences. And so, you know, without a specific instance, it's hard to comment on exactly what families should do.
Sure.
But I do think if your child feels harassed, if your child feels unsafe, you absolutely do want to do something. And you can also get advice from an independent mental health professional outside of the school if it's upsetting your child or if they're experiencing depression around it. So that's another thing, is you may want to just marshal all the support that you can.
It almost sounds like parents need to take at least a literacy course themselves in terms of dealing with social media so that they can reasonably guide their children.
ask your child to teach you, though. If your child is on an app, they should be able to show it to you. If they're using Snapchat, if they're using Musical.ly, have them show it to you. So it shouldn't be on us as parents to try to have a PhD in Snapchat. I mean, you don't need to know that much to understand a little bit of your kid's experience. You know, it's enough to know, oh, this is where people share their parties. Well, if your kid's not getting invited to a lot of parties, Snapchat might not be like the world's most fun experience.
Gotcha. Are there times when parents should just cut off the child's access to social media altogether, or is that even reasonable?
I think it's tough to do. I mean, if you take away their home device, they may be able to access on a school device. Kids get really attached. But I do think there might be situations where, you know, turning it off for some time could be a sensible consequence. Like if someone, for example, if you find out that your child is harassing someone else or they're using technology in a way that's making someone else uncomfortable, certainly they need to kind of hit a hard stop and a reset. You know, you may not want to cut them off for years and years, but they may need some time to really rethink what they've done. And I think that's one way to do it. I wouldn't use that as your go-to for everything. You know, if your kid didn't clean their room, I would try to have, you know, sort of a consequence that fits the crime a little more, as opposed to like, you didn't clean your room, you're off Instagram, you didn't,
I see.
you know, walk the dog when I said you're off Instagram. Like, I wouldn't use it for your everything because you don't want your kid to start lying to you and going around you or just saying, okay, well, I don't care about that. But I think for all of us as parents, we have to find ways to work with our kids, and especially as they get to be teenagers, sometimes the consequence is its own. You know, if your child offends someone on social media and is paying a social consequence, you may not need to add to that consequence. It depends on the situation.
One of the things that it seems are really important for parents and teachers to understand is how the teachers are wanting the child to use apps, how the teachers are intending on using technology in the classroom, and perhaps even consulting with parents before that school year begins. Is that reasonable or unreasonable? Teachers are so busy.
I think that it's helpful if possible. If teachers can even just communicate some basic preferences with parents, like I prefer to communicate by email, or this is my, you know, sort of expected response time, or I'm going to be maintaining a Twitter account for the class and this is where you can follow it. I think that's very helpful for parents. I don't think teachers necessarily need to do a massive amount of front-loaded work on this topic, but I do think that parents should expect in elementary school, when most kids have one primary teacher, that every year there'll be something different, that, you know, every teacher is going to be slightly different about how they do it. And then in middle and high school, it's complex, right? Because you're dealing with multiple teachers, and then you just have to also, again, let your child be your friend a little bit and say, if your teacher is sharing information with me on a blog, can you show me how to access that blog?
Okay. So really have the child collaborate with you in terms of your learning. It kind of helps to open up the space to have lots of conversations, it would seem, if you're asking your child to help you figure things out.
It's a great way to see what they know and what they don't know, and for you to share in their day-to-day experience, and also for them to get to feel like an expert that's teaching you something, which is a very positive thing for our kids.
Now, what about gaming? So many times, at least I see ads for games, and the games are pretty horrifying. Do you have any thoughts about children and their participation in games on the internet?
I think that there are some games that I personally don't feel like they don't attract me. They don't suit my taste culture. I don't like them, but my kid might someday want to play them. So I have to, if my kid is asking about it, I have to know about it. If I don't need to know, I'm not going to make myself an expert. Some games are very positive. I think that there are a lot of games where kids are having very good experiences. They're learning to collaborate. They're being quite creative. They're encountering interesting challenges, they're expanding their cognitive abilities. Even some of the games we don't like, they're probably expanding some cognitive abilities and fine motor skills and reaction time. Those violent games make me more personally uncomfortable, but the research suggests that kids don't become violent from violent video games. And so I do believe that research. That said, I personally don't like them. And so you know, I have my own rules about what can be in my house and what my child can play. But I think
the realistically, when he's older and he's with friends, he's going to be exposed to a lot of other games, so we need to talk about those games. One thing we want to think about with kids is, are they playing on a public server and are they playing with strangers? And I would suggest for younger elementary schoolers that they probably shouldn't be playing with strangers. And as they get older and maybe more discerning and ready to be on a server with strangers, we really want to know a lot about that experience. You know, does that mean those people's voices are in your living room with your child? Has your child ever been asked who they are and where they live? We need to give our kids a lot of information about how to interact and what to do if they feel uncomfortable.
And certainly if a child is being asked, if anyone is being asked where they live and being asked for pictures, that should in theory be a red flag for anybody, everybody. Yes?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. But even young kids may just not even know that that's scary and creepy, whereas the teenagers, for example, would be like, why do you want to know? What's wrong? You know, like, that's weird. So I think as kids get older, they tend to be more aware of this stuff, but not at least in the kids that I talk to. But a fifth grader might or might not know, and you have to really look at your child and say, is this kid ready to play with strangers and all that?
And meeting strangers on the internet is so scary. You know, it could be somebody who is telling you they're a 15-year-old girl and they're a 45-year-old man.
Absolutely.
So how do you or can you protect your child from that if they really think they're talking to a 15-year-old girl and they're not?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if your child is forming more of a relationship or a friendship with someone, I think it's reasonable to say, please introduce me to them. Can I talk to them? And, you know, to say, hi, I'm so-and-so's mom. And so tell me a little more. And I think your ability to kind of read for some of those questions, like, so you're a 15-year-old girl, like, you know, where do you go to school? And if they act like that's creepy, that might be fine, right? Because they shouldn't maybe be telling you that either. But you can start to assess a little bit about what's going on in your kid's relationship. You could ask for a video chat as well as a parent. Maybe you don't want your child video chatting this person, but ask them to show up and video chat with you.
Well, that's an interesting one. And is there a way to set up a video chat so that your child does not have access to it?
Absolutely. I mean, you could even do it when your child isn't there, or you can do it with your child there. I guess I'm not totally sure what you mean. I mean, if you have Skype or another app enabled on a device, your child will be able to use it to communicate with the people they choose from. And there's a lot of ways to do that. There's Google Hangout. I mean, there's so many video chat opportunities. I think it's very important that parents know that kids are not video chatting with strangers. And so I would definitely talk to them. It's funny, I feel like we're talking more about safety issues, and that's not the thing I tend to focus on the most. I'm really much more focused on just how do we live with technology in a way that supports our relationships and family life. So your kid may want to video chat with their grandmother or their cousin or... So I would really focus on video chat is for people we already know, not a place to meet people.
Gotcha. You talk about the importance of creating a tech-positive environment. What is a tech-positive environment?
It's an environment where we're running our lives and not, you know, if there our tech isn't running us, right? Where we are making decisions every day about how we want to use technology, how it might extend certain experiences or capabilities. And also when we want to turn it off and when we want to unplug. So that, to me, that's a tech positive environment, as opposed to feeling guilty, which I think a lot of parents end up feeling quite guilty about the ways we use technology in our families or the ways we use technology in our lives. And I think that that is unfortunate. I don't think it's helpful because it actually isolates us from other parents who could be an amazing resource for us when we can't admit that we are having a challenge with our child and phones or that we're struggling, then sometimes, you know, actually a problem could get a lot worse because we're trying to be so quiet about it.
I see. You also talk about the need to create boundaries. And I would just think that creating a boundary in the world of technology for anyone would be kind of hard to do.
Yeah, it is. I mean, but you can think about things, so simple things like not using your phone as an alarm so that it's not in your bedroom at night could create a boundary, or having your kids and yourself be ready to express a boundary verbally, like, oh, take calls after 8 because I'm with my son helping with homework and reading to him. Or your child could say, hey, I can't text after 8 because I have homework.
I see.
And that helps reduce what I call connectivity anxiety, where we feel nervous that other people will try to reach us and we won't be accessible and they'll be upset with us.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue with Dr. Devorah Heitner, who is author of ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Heitner, so many adults, I would suggest, live in the world where they say to their children, don't do what I do, do what I say. And I raise that because you make the very clear comment that it is important for the adults, for the parents, for the teachers, to be mindful of their own usage of technology. Why is that so important? And do you think that parents or adults in general have a hard time doing that?
I think it's very tough. We're all in a world where our extended family and our jobs, that everyone has access to us, and people will try to call you, then they'll try to call your spouse, they'll try your landline and your cell phone. It's very hard to get away. When I was a kid, it was sort of expected that, for example, if a family went away for a vacation, you just couldn't reach them. Like, that was it. They were away. And now that's not the expectations. People put away messages on if they're going to be away for more than a day from their email. The expectation is, you know, we need to give people something. They can't just deal with the idea that we might be unavailable. And so we need to help our kids accustom themselves, you know, to that idea. And I think, I don't know, I think it's a cultural shift, and I think we can do it, but it's tough, and they need to see us putting our phones away. And I find it really hard to do myself. I get on my computer often early in the morning to do work emails. And then when my son wakes up, I have to really work on myself to put the computer away and not just let him drift off into another room and kind of do his own thing. And even if he's not ready to really engage with me fully, he needs to see that I've put my computer away and that I'm looking at him, I'm available. Our kids are very sensitive to when we're available. So even if they're not directly approaching us and saying, mommy, mommy, they may be sensing that we're not really with them. And so we do need to be available some of the time and be clear when we're not. If I am working on something and my son is around, that could be fine. But I need to be clear with myself and with him that I'm actually working and distracted and that I'm not available. I think it's, we tell ourselves we're available when we're not. You know, we want to believe that we can be doing everything at once.
The boss who all but requires you to be available 24/7. Maybe not the healthiest boss in the world for one to work for or with.
Absolutely. And a lot of the best companies now and places that people are pretty excited to work for, like Google, are saying, hey, let's think about this and let's not be accessible to our teams at all times. And, you know, I know in Germany they were considering a law where, oh, you know, overtime would have to be paid if you're going to email your colleagues, you know, at odd hours. And I think there's something very smart about at least introducing those ideas and saying, you know, are we really even productive when we're on 24/7? If you get a great idea in the middle of the night, you can write it down and share it with your colleagues tomorrow. You don't need to email them all right now and make their phones ding in their bedrooms where they're no doubt sleeping with their phones like everyone is.
The idea that one can, particularly as parents, but certainly as children too, the idea of establishing boundaries that you can actually hold to, I would suggest is not something that we typically think about in the world of social media, but as you describe it, it's very doable and it's actually healthy.
Absolutely. And even just making decisions, am I going to friend all these people at work or am I not going to friend anyone at work? And I know that gets very tricky. I know a lot of people can be offended if you say you have those boundaries, but I think it, you know, if it's much easier if you just say, oh, I just don't do social media with people at work or whatever. I mean, and I'm not suggesting that that's a boundary that everyone should have. I'm just suggesting that's an example of like you could hold that as a boundary. But there are so many different things that could work for different people. And I think it's just really important that you feel like you can change your boundaries too. If something isn't working for you, if being accessible at a certain level, for example, isn't working with you and it's feeling exhausting, then, you know, you could change it.
And I think the perhaps underscored throughout all of that is that you really certainly as the parent or the adult, you do have the right to set a limit and you can set the limit whether or not other people are appreciative of the limit that you've set.
Absolutely. And that it is your prerogative for sure.
You say that it's important to model empathy. What does empathy have to do with social media?
We need to remember that there's someone else on the other end of all these communications. We need to remember there are human beings receiving these texts and emails and reading my posts and seeing the news that I announce. And maybe I just got some wonderful news and someone else is having a really crummy day and my news doesn't rub them the right way, or the other way around. I might see something that makes me feel really envious or left out. It's just good to remember there's another person on the other end of all of this.
Is there any amount of screen time that's too much, or would you make that decision based on the child's developmental progress or their ages, or is any time okay time?
I think it really depends on your family and what's going on. I mean, I think over a winter break that a lot of us have coming up, or for some people, you know, other times like when they're more available, there might be a lot of screen time and it could really work with your family. Maybe you're going to go see a double feature with your family. That's a tradition in my family for certain holidays. That could be, you know, 4 hours of screen time in the same day, but we don't do that every day. I live in a place where it gets very cold in the winter. My kid gets a lot more screen time when it's 10 below, you know, than when it's, you know, 70 and sunny. So I think we have to really look at our families, look at what else is going on. If it's interfering with sleep, family relationships, other activities, homework, then it's too much. If it's not, then it may be fine.
But, you know, it occurs to me that as we're talking about all of this, that social media actually is a part of our lives. It's a part of our household. It's a part of our families, whether we want it to be or not. So it would be really wise to be more mindful about how it works and how you want to work with it.
Exactly. When my niece just got proposed to, right, her partner proposed to her. And there's a video of the proposal. And of course I wanted to watch that with my husband and my son yesterday. So I saw it and then I said, oh, you guys have to see this. Guess what? Emily's getting married. We have to look at this. And it was so exciting. So that's a shared moment in our family based on social media.
And it's a good thing. You know, I think that too many times parents in particular, folks who are a bit older than what we think of as millennials, may see the internet as a big bad monster. But in fact, it really can be very helpful and open up worlds of information that we might not otherwise have access to.
Absolutely. But we want to live, you know, live with it in a way that doesn't derail our lives. And I think it is truly challenging. We don't want to make our kids feel bad when they get distracted or when they spend longer than they plan to, because it can happen to any of us, honestly.
It also sounds like it's in the household that the adults in the household who are charged with caring for the children in the household need to have a clear conversation between themselves about how they see social media being used in that particular household. It's not something that you necessarily just want to play by ear until you can't.
Exactly. I think parents, especially before they get their child, for example, a first phone, you know, that's a very heavy decision that you want to make with all the people raising that kid. And for example, in a situation where partners are no longer together, that can be very challenging because there may be one household that's more ready than another, but it has to be ideally compromised. It's not something you want to just bring on someone. Certainly not a gift you want to spring on your grandchildren when they don't live with you or anything like that. You definitely want all the people who have a day-to-day kind of relationship with that child to be on board.
For those listening, is there something of a checklist that you can go through with us that would indicate whether or not someone is savvy, if you will, about screen time, or needs to do a little bit more work, a little bit more research in terms of thinking how they want to use screen time or make it available?
Well, I would ask yourself, if your child has their own device or their own app, if you are familiar with what, even just knowing what they're using and how it fits into their lives, that would be a question I would ask myself. If your child is younger and maybe more involved with, like, watching TV or watching YouTube, you know, who do they watch? What are they attracted to? What is their behavior like when they're watching? Do you feel like your own technology habits are a good role model for your children? What would your children say if I or someone else asked your children, what is your mom or dad's worst technology habit? What would your child say? These are some questions. And then also, have you identified anyone in your community who's maybe an expert on certain things? I know there are some parents in my community who are more expert on gaming than me. So if I had a question about gaming, I could go to them.
And, you know, it's also a really good question that you posed a moment ago. If someone is to ask your child what mom or dad's worst habit is, what would the child say? And I would imagine that there might be some very interesting comments made.
Oh, I think we would learn a lot. It's a scary question to ask your kids, but I think, you know, if you do it in a fun way, you can have a great conversation as a family. You have to be ready for what they're going to say, though, right?
Well,
you have to be ready that you might feel guilty.
That's true, too. Are we in danger of losing sight of the social interactions, the person-to-person interactions that are so critical to human growth and development as we become more aware and more savvy of social media?
I don't believe so. I think people still want to get together with their friends. I think they still want to have in-person social experiences. And I think that kids still really value their in-person relationships and their face-to-face time. But I do think we need to help our kids and be sure that they have those skills and that they know, hey, even if you're upset, you know, by something that's happening on a text, you don't want to text back. You want to see someone in person to work it out. That's the best way to work out a problem. So it's important for our kids to know that. And if they say, well, that's awkward, which is what a lot of kids will say about a lot of social situations that are challenging, you would have to say something like, you know, the best things in life are awkward. The most important things in life are awkward, right? Asking someone a hard question is awkward, but that's how you're going to get to the next level in your relationship. You can never just avoid awkwardness at all times, right?
So the idea that your child is absolutely committed, addicted to social media in one way, shape, or form, or gaming or any of those things, is it important as a parent that you insist that your child break away from that and go out and be with friends and family? Or do you want to just let the child kind of do his or her own thing?
I think that if you feel that it's really destructive and getting in their way, then you want to take action and work with the child and say, I see this getting in your way. What can we do about it? Like, what's a way to help you kind of change this habit? Right. So I would really go to your child, just like if you were having trouble getting your child to keep their homework organized or, you know, their room clean or anything else. Or if you were concerned about choices they were making in their friendship, you wouldn't just impose a solution. Right. You would work with them and say, well, what, and that doesn't mean you can't have any input, but they need to be involved and co-create that solution with you.
Good point. The idea that parents perhaps might advocate for teachers or even their own PTA groups to do a regular sort of here's what's going on in the world of social media meeting, does that make sense?
I think that that could be great. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I do. So, of course, I like when schools bring me in to have that conversation. I try to get beyond the conversation about sort of specific apps, which I think a lot of people want to have, and move into a deeper conversation about how kids are really using social media, how it fits into their lives and their friendships. I think that's a deeper chat than sometimes parents realize they're kind of getting into when they come see me when I speak at school. But I do think it's productive. And I think that parents, obviously, they can bring an outside speaker. That's great. Not every school has the resources for that. I think having parents share their own experiences or having a panel of kids present to parents, again, as experts. The kids are experts. They know a lot about this stuff. So you want to know about House Party, you want to know about Musical.ly, you want to know about Snapchat, well, go to a high school and ask a 16-year-old. They will break it down for you. I'd be very surprised if there weren't kids at your local high school who could give a very good, clear explanation with demonstration about those things.
Well, that's a great idea to have the kids put on a presentation.
I think it would be really fun, and I've seen schools do it really successfully.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be really fun. Are there any things that a parent who's listening to our conversation today, is there anything that you would like for them to do first as they embark on being more aware of their own sensitivity, if you will, or awareness of social media, the existence of social media in their child's life?
I think you want to remember that you have wisdom, that you've been through conflicts, that you've been not invited to the party, that you've seen people talking negatively about a third person and not knowing what to do or felt uncomfortable. We've all been in those situations. And those are not so new. The experiences our kids will have are mediated in a different format, but they're not new human experience. So trust that you have the wisdom to guide your child, that you can be there for your child. Even if you are not on Snapchat, you know that it's painful to not be invited to a party. And you can help your child through that experience and support them, even though you had that experience, you know, in a different way at a different time.
I think that's so important that parents remember that they do have wisdom, and it is wisdom that is useful and can and should be shared with the younger folks in their lives.
Exactly.
Dr. Devora Heitner, author of Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Is there a website folks can go to get more information about you and what you're doing?
Absolutely. RaisingDigitalNatives.com is my website, and I have a blog there where I talk about a lot of these issues, how families can deal with these questions, how to come up with rules. My mentorship manifesto is there. There's a link to Screenwise, my book. So I think my website is kind of ground zero for a lot of great information that families find helpful.
Sounds ideal. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you about this.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available online daily by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store and carry Mind Talk with you wherever you go. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, the email address is pamela@mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.